It was such a popular place.
It was a beautiful
for years.
Yeah, it was a beautiful spot too. I mean,
a nice spot, and I don't know if the ownership just got tired of the thing or
I know they
got old, and
because Fred Klum that owned it was pretty old back then.
Yeah, the Klums had it for years.
And then their sons had drug problems. I know one of them did and was in prison for a while for cocaine. So, you know, maybe it just fell on hard times, not enough right support.
That's something like that. You remember Wallstrom's there in Harvey?
Yeah, yeah.
That was started by that family. And then.
Oh, it was? By the Wallstroms?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know.
And then the mother and father, and they were there for a long time, and then they turned it over to their sons. But the one of them, I think, that was running Wallstrom's had a drug problem, and it just went downhill.
Yeah,
it just went right downhill. It just
it's unfortunate if you don't have someone that's passionate about it, then.
Yeah,
like
you
anything.
Just, you know, those like any business, you really got to keep on top of things.
Yeah, you do, or otherwise people they're not going to spend their money there.
Yeah. Same as that, quick question, then whatever you want to start. But is that Crawford County Avalanche still publishing?
Yeah, it was last I know, yes. Yeah, that was.
And I worked for a long time in communications, and we used to deal with all the newspapers around Michigan, you know, in the Midwest. And I remember the Avalanche there. I always thought that kind of an odd name.
It is kind of odd name.
Or distinct, let me put it that way.
Yeah. I mean, what's Avalanche have anything to do with Crawford County at all? You know, it's pretty flat, sort of, generally speaking, so.
Yeah. No, well, there's skiing there, isn't there?
There is one ski hill, Hanson
Not
Hills.
Not like Gaylord, though, huh?
No, and not really anything like Marquette, really, for that
side.
Oh,
not like Marquette, no.
No, so it's just, you know, maybe a little bump on
you. Yeah, we've been through Gaylord for years and years, and sometimes we stop and eat there, you know, with
right.
75.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Yeah, fairly frequently.
We were just down through there just a short time ago.
Huh.
Well, I didn't mean to take up your time
no,
here.
Sorry. So I've been looking at a lot of your records and doing the Northwind, and basically there's some things I just don't understand about it. And so how did you get involved with this American Indian program? How did you're the one.
Well, it was, it wasn't any big formal startup. I had been teaching in Grand Rapids, and then I got or that area, and I grew up in a little place called Grand Marais. Did you ever hear that up on Lake Superior?
Oh, yeah. For sure.
And so then I went to Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, and then I taught in Grand Rapids for a few years. And I went over to Spring Lake, which isn't too far, you know, Grand Haven, Spring Lake. And I had a friend that owned the Munising News, and he wanted to go. He had pretty much got his degree working on, but he had a little bit more to do up at Northern, and he wanted to take off and go to summer school. So he said, "Will you come on up and edit the paper?" Well, I had never edited a newspaper, but I liked to write, and I had written a few historical articles for the paper and so forth. So I did come up, but I had every intention of going back to Spring Lake. But it was funny, towards the end of the summer, I was up here in Marquette, and I don't know why, I went by the mining journal, and I said, geez, I like this work. Maybe I did go in there and see if they got an opening. So I did, and they had in the editorial department, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I never went back to teaching, and was in the journal, and then after... I was there about 4 years, and then this Pat Farrell hired me out in the research development office.
All right.
And involved in grant writing. Well, that was one of the things. And then we had the field station east of north and east of Shingleton there in the summers. And research and development was kind of an open-ended thing. You were involved in... grant writing was primarily, you know, for the faculty and staff, and it was kind of an open-ended thing. So then we had the University Press there,
right?
Published a few books, you know, over the years. But so it was just kind of odd way I got into it. I've got a little Indian blood, Ojibwe, and I've got relatives up in Keweenaw Bay and over in the Sioux.
All right.
You know. But I never identified myself. Well, I don't have enough of that blood, but I didn't identify myself with that, and I wasn't greatly interested in it. But it was just funny that I can pin it or trace it back. One time I had there was a meeting here in Marquette. And I can't remember who sponsored it. If it was the BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I don't remember just what the deal was, but there was this guy, Herman Cameron, from Bay Mills, you know where that is,
yeah.
The Sioux area. And he was quite he was well along in years, but he was quite active in Indian affairs down there. And I was assigned to cover the meeting, and it wasn't a big public meeting, but there was, Herman was one of the guys on the, kind of a panel, if I recall, and he talked about I don't want to call it injustices, but one of the problems of the Native American, you know, and I don't know. It just, it just opened my eyes a lot. And he wasn't one of these firebrands or anything like that, you know. But he just really inspired me about that thing. So, I mean, I just covered it and wrote the article.
Right.
For the Mining Journal. And I don't know if it was a year or two or what later I went to Northern and got into the research and development. That was in 68. Well, then, in the spring of 69, Pat Farrell had a stroke. And he had to leave that office.
What office was he in at the time?
Research and development.
He had been
teaching in geography. And President Hardin at the time asked him if he would come over and head that. There was a guy that headed it there, and then he left Northern. And Pat went over and, I know it was reluctantly, but he went over and he headed that office. And then, he was there about, I don't know, see, Roy Heath left in 60. I think Pat was there about 2 years. Then he had that stroke. And then he never came back to the office. When he recovered, he went back over to geography, which he really liked. And he was mainly a cartographer.
Yes.
And he was really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I liked Pat a lot. But anyway, so they asked me to, I guess as an interim or whatever, to keep things going there in the office. And I don't know, this whole thing about the Indian came to more to my attention, and this one, I don't remember just exactly, there was a Jerry DeFont that was, she was involved in quite a few social things around the, not social, but I don't want to say. She had been a union representative, and she was very much involved in helping people, you know, that way. And I don't remember just what it was, but this one guy from Sault Ste. Marie, an Indian student, I don't know if Jerry had referred him to see if there was something maybe to come and talk to me in the office. And This guy was he was in his 30s, an older fellow, really wanted to improve himself, but very, I don't want to call it shy, but not too outspoken. You know, he had difficulty communicating, and we just kind of connected, and I don't forget what we did something. And I just got to thinking about the things that are the problems that Native Americans had, not just in the Upper Peninsula, but generally, and the discrimination. And, the injustices that they had suffered over the years. I mean, I wasn't the one to go out in the street with a banner or something like that, but I just thought, man, there's a lot of stuff here that needs to be addressed. And back in 1968 or 69, we were still a long ways to go, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There was still a lot of ferment around the country, and of course the Vietnam War was going on and all that stuff. So, like I say, I've always been a writer, and I a tendency to express myself that way. And so, I thought, there must be a copy of it there in the archives. But I wrote what amounted to like a white paper. Yeah. And, I mean, I'd never done that kind of thing before, but I did. And I sent it around to the president and to the vice presidents and to various people on campus and tried to kind of outline what I thought, you know, we could get involved in. And President Jamrich had come that year, and of course I didn't know that he had a quite strong personal interest in that, Native Americans. He didn't express it much at that time because he had just gotten there. But anyway, I did a lot of this in a kind of a naive way, you know, not thinking that I'm going to start something, but I just, something that should be done, and I did it, and I didn't know how far anything would go, you know. It wasn't with a long-term plan or anything, but I just wrote that letter, or that white paper. And it went around, and I heard a few of the VPs commenting, and I thought, well, you know, it's great. I hadn't expected any. I didn't know what to. I didn't expect what. I didn't know. I just did it. So, like I say, the research and development office is very flexible. We had a budget that we could get involved. It's like the name research and development. I mean, the development end. You know, it was kind of open-ended. Here we had the field station out there, and which was academic there, and used to, and then we had the university press, and then, you know, we had a kind of a catch-all. As much as you wanted to do, in a sense, if it was, you know, something that was legitimate. So, anyway, we had a... there was quite a few changes then. We had a new vice president that came in. I got to tell you something funny. We had a vice president for academic affairs, and when Pat got sick, and I had that, and it just happened at the time that we were under the academic vice president's jurisdiction. And I gotta kind of think a little bit on some of this, the sequence of some of this stuff.
Who was the person that you're talking about that was the vice president?
Well, names of that. There was a Jacob Vinegar.
Yes.
Who was, maybe you remember Jake.
I don't remember my time. I remember
but you know the name probably.
Yeah, from doing the research on this.
Yeah. In the meantime, I was kind of, I don't know, talking to people about stuff, and we formed a Native American Advisory Committee.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out.
I mean,
who was
I had nobody told me that I up above that I could do that, and I, you know, that's how naive I was. I thought, well, if you want to do something, just go ahead and do it. So anyway. We got up this committee, and one thing that I think we got off on the right track, universities at that time, most often would if they were forming a committee like that, they picked out the people that they wanted to work with and want to do something for the Indians, you know. Well, we thought that what we would do is get an advisory committee of Indians and have them tell us what they think we should do, what they wanted done. Because a lot of times those Indian programs at that time didn't go too far because it was something almost like, here, we're doing this for you. And the Indians weren't involved in the,
in the decision.
So we got that up. Well, anyway, I got, Jake Vinegar wasn't a very good communicator. I mean, he wasn't a very affable person. And one day I got a phone ring and there was Jake on the other line and he said, who the hell gave you permission to start an Indian program here? Oh, I didn't. I just kind of mumbled, and nobody had. So anyway, that's the part of the genesis of the Indian program. Well, anyway, we got this, maybe I'm getting way off.
No, you're right on. You're perfect.
We had this, we got a good committee together because we asked other Indians, you know, who should we tap on this? We got people from Lawrence, the Keweenaw Bay, to St. Marie, of course. This Mike Wright steered us on to some people. Then we got a real good Potawatomi guy, and I can't remember his name, but he'd be in the archives, from down near Kalamazoo. You know, there's Potawatomis over there. There's a group of them. And then, of course, they're over here by Annaville, by Escanaba. Well, we got somebody there, and we got Willis Jackson from Mount Pleasant there, Isabella. And then we got the Dominics. Both are involved, husband and wife from Petoskey. Because, you know, there's a bunch around there. Mm-hmm. And then we got a guy from up in Bemidji, Minnesota, because we wanted to take a look at not just different things to do for the, you know, the regular programs, but academic stuff too. And they had developed already a kind of an academic program up at Bemidji State. And he was Indian. Oh, yeah, they were all Indians. And then we got a guy in the name of Kelly Perro from Lawrence. But they had an office. It was kind of under the state's jurisdiction, but it was an Indian, like for economic development and maybe, I don't know, I forget we used to use the acronym, but it was some kind of the name, council in the name. But Kelly, he had a lumber yard up at Lawrence, but he headed that up.
All right.
Real sharp guy, Chip was there from Lawrence. So those, I'm forgetting a few, but that's basically, we had a pretty good cross-section. We had the guy from Bemidji. He was, I'd call him an educator. Some of the Indians, like the guy down in the Potawatomi, I think he had a connection with Michigan State.
Mm. I'm
trying to remember. I mean, this is quite a while back.
Yeah,
don't look at the stuff, you know. So that was our advisory committee. And I remember one of the first meetings we had. We had a meeting up at Zeba, which is right near Lawrence, but it's like the Indian community there. It's just east of Lawrence there, right on the bay. And we went up and we, because we wanted to go to them, not just them come to us. So we went to their town hall there in Zeba, and we had a meeting. And Dr. Strolley, by this time, had replaced Jake Vinegar, who didn't stay. He stayed at Northern, but he wasn't. We weren't under him. Strolley came and he became graduate dean and then continuing education, vice president and like that. And we were under him. good guy to work for. We got along great, and he went up with us. And
who else went up with you? Just you and him?
Oh no, not just me. It was myself and Dr. Strolley. There weren't too many from Northern. I can't remember now. Lou Peters from biology. His wife was an Oneida. His first wife, she died, but she was an Oneida from Wisconsin. Lou was always very interested. He wasn't Indian, but he was very interested in. And helpful. There were some Indian leaders there that, I wouldn't say raked us over the coals, but said, do you guys really want to help us, you know, or do you want to find out, you know, what we really need? It wasn't something like us going there and saying, well, hey, you know, we want to do something for you. It's just like, you know, what would you like to have us do? That way. And it was, I won't say it was a rough meeting, but a very frank meeting. That was one of the first that we had.
Well, was there issues? Were they just doubtful or skeptical that you were going to do anything, or what?
Oh, no. There was, the tribal chairman up there, Fred Dakota, I don't know if that, he was chairman for years, and then he was out for quite a while. The Dakotas, I think one of his sons is on the tribal council. I had my cousins are Indians up there, and they're members of the Kibanabe tribe, and one of my cousins was on the Michigan Indian Commission, and she was chairman of it for a while.
Right.
So they were quite active, but they weren't at that meeting, because I didn't have anything to do with that, with who was going to come. The Kibanabe people set that up, their people, see. And so, we talked about stuff that I'm sure you'd be, well aware of. Indian culture, preserving their language, educational opportunities, and you know that kind of thing. But one of the things I remember, then the meeting it lasted, I don't know, part of one day, and then we came back. And we kept in touch. They were good people to, you know, to be in touch with as you were developing the program. And so Dr. Strolley, and I didn't know it at the time, but I found out later, Dr. Jamrich, the president, was very supportive of Indian, of that sort of thing. I mean, he let you go with, you know, carry the ball, but I realized as the time went on that, boy, he had our back, you know, on all kinds of stuff. And so one day Kelly Perro came up from St. Ignace or down from Lawrence, I don't know which direction, but he came and we had a good meeting, and he said, you know, one of the major things that we need as Indians is a means of communication, like a newspaper. Because you know, the secular press wasn't giving Indians very good ink, you know, in that time. I mean, it was almost always slanted, or, you know, just like we did with blacks.
Right.
And so he said, I've been trying to get a newspaper funded, and he told me the different foundations that he had approached. Through this Michigan council that was there at the Sioux, or at the St. Ignace. And they all thought it was a good idea, but they all turned him down for grant money to start up a paper, not a daily or a weekly, but just a periodical. And so I stop and think here a minute. I thought it was a good idea. Of course, I'd been with newspapers and that sort of thing. I had a little bit of knowledge there about how things worked. And then I was in, had research and development. We were doing grant writing all the time. So I thought, I'll take a stab at grant writing and see what we can do. And the president, I'm trying to remember if we, I must have cleared it with somebody. I think Dr. Strolley, maybe. I don't know if I went up to as far as the president or not. It must have. Maybe I had something in that white paper. I don't know. I can't remember exactly the sequence. But at any rate, we tried all kinds of phone, the Ford Foundation.
I remember seeing
all the biggies.
I saw a lot of
them. I had a foundation directly like that. Of course, we use it for other grant applications, too. So I did a series of applications, and I had the same results as Kelly did. Oh, this is good, but, you know, they didn't want to get into an Indian newspaper.
Why do you think that was?
It was considered just like maybe they wouldn't have gotten into a black newspaper at that time. There was possibility for controversy, and they just didn't want to touch it, but they were, you know, very nice, but they just turned us all down. And we had some students, like this Mike Wright that came from the Sioux, and some other students that had, the word was getting around. You know, the Indians communicate. We say they need a communication, but they've got a kind of, you know, a drum, let me put it that way, that stuff gets around. And there was getting around that Northern was going to try to do something. Along with, you know, with the Indian people, not for the Indians, but with the Indians. But so we were getting, picking up a few more students around. And President Jammrich must have known about our efforts there. I must have communicated with him by some way or another. And I told him, you know, we just can't get any money for this newspaper. And, of course, I had contacted some printers. We knew what kind of money we needed. And the students would, still got a picture. And I know there's some in the archive. The first meeting we had up in Old K Hall there of those nucleus of students forming this Anishinaabe News. And, so the president said, how much do you need? Well, we needed $10,000 to get things going and to maybe publish for a year or whatever. So the president said, I'll take it out of my discretionary fund. And he, President Jammrich, funded that, the Anishinaabe News. And if it wasn't for him, and I can tell you other things too that he involved in, but that's how we got started, and that Anishinaabe News was the real catalyst. And not only it was a communications means for the Indian community, and it turned out, heck, we were going all over the United States with that Anishinaabe News, not in great numbers, because the largest circulation we had was about 7,000. But it covered all the reservations in Michigan and in Canada over there across in this general area, Lake Superior, Lake Huron, and like that. And then, word got out around, and, we got requests from libraries, both the United States, Canada, around, and, you know, it went to in government offices. It went to some pretty influential, not just in the Indian community, but otherwise. And at that time, there were four major, three major Native American papers that had gotten going all about the same time. There was Akwesasne Notes that the Mohawks were publishing up in northern New York State at Roosevelt Town, New York, right on the Canadian border. And then there was us, the Anishinaabe News. And then there was Wasaha, which was started, backing up, the Akwesasne Notes started just like northern Anishinaabe, University of Connecticut got it going. Mm. But then you know, that was a pretty outspoken paper. And they got it off their campus pretty quick. It had to go off on its own. And I had pressure at Northern, too, after Dr. Neeby, he was the dean of the vice president for student affairs, and he said, we got to get this paper off campus. This was after about a year or so. Of course, we never did. And then the University of one of the campuses, University of California, started this Wausau, just like we did, just like Connecticut did. And it was published in conjunction with the university, but I think that was off, got off campus too after a while. So those were the three. Akwesasne and Anishinaabe and Wausau. And so, they were recognized as the three major Native American newspapers at the time.
What was the reason for wanting it off campus? Was there just...
Because things were really happening with the Native American community. They were starting to really speak up for themselves. And, well, you know, Wounded Knee out there. We had students that were on the paper that were with that AI, were pretty, very sympathetic with AIM, American Indian Movement, which was involved at Wounded Knee, you know. And there were some, a lot of things were happening then, and some things were kind of unsettling, you know, or controversial.
Just prejudices of white people towards Indians at the time, you think, or something of that?
What's that?
Just a prejudice from white people towards Indians and Indians being more...
I don't hear too good. I only have hearing in one ear.
No, I was just wondering if it had to do with prejudice, maybe, feeling towards Indians that...
Prejudice?
Oh.
Well, I mean, this whole... It was just a kind of parallel to the black... movement at the time. In fact, some of the higher ups at Northern, one of the vice presidents said, why don't we combine the Native American and black programs? Because a lot of that stuff was happening. Boy, the Indians, they didn't have any prejudice against the blacks, but boy, they didn't want to be in with the blacks. They wanted their own, you know. And I think the blacks felt the same way. Because we were developing those things at Northern, both of them. I wasn't involved with the black, but I was with the Indian. So anyway, one time, I mean, the paper wasn't something that was a flaming, radical thing at all. We had, we had all kinds of stuff in there. The thing that I want to emphasize is that, I won't say I was a bystander, but once we got the ball rolling, we had some Indian students who were just outstanding. And like getting up with the newspaper, I didn't do any writing for that paper. I knew how to get it going, and I knew, I always kept an eye on stuff, and I had close communications all the time with the students, and then my R&D budget, we had student labor money, and there was no restrictions. So, boy, I hired, for a while there, the students working on the Anishinaabe News, I paid their you know, out of student labor.
All right.
That kind of stuff. And so, I mean, we didn't leave any stone unturned, as long as I didn't catch hell for it.
All right. All right.
So, anyway... yeah, we had you've probably seen some of the back copies,
yes,
of the Anishinaabe News. I mean, we had all kinds of stuff there. The students generated it. Then they got correspondence, and we had a guy, I mean, it was so interesting. There was this one guy who had been out here in Marquette Prison, Indian fellow, and he might have still been there, but he had a really deep interest in the Ojibwa language. Jake, I can't remember his last name. But he did a regular column on the language, And it was very well done. We published that. We published news from the various reservations, but certainly with a major concentration in our service area, you know. They had letters to the editor. They had recipes. I mean, anything of interest to the Indian community. And then we had a couple of, one in particular, an Indian fellow. I don't know if he wasn't at the university at all, but he was in the eastern end of the UP, or I don't know. But anyway, he was an excellent pen and ink artist. Mm. And Indian people like to have illustrations. I mean, just a straight news column and maybe photos and stuff, but they did a lot of illustrating stuff, and our masthead, they always had a nice pen and ink thing. They did that. That was all Indian students that did that. I mean, it would be, I don't know. If you go look at the papers at all of those pen and ink drawings were done by the Indians, you know, themselves, the students involved with the paper. Although that, and then Indians were involved with that paper who were in the northern, didn't even live around here. Oh. It really brought the Indian community together in a way that they had never done it before, because they didn't, a newspaper can do that.
Right.
And we started out as a tabloid. And they would bring all this stuff up to the Globe there in Ishpeming, and they put out, in a tabby form probably. We came out about every month, every 6 weeks. We didn't have a stated schedule, but that was about the time that it took for the students, because they did it all on their extra time, you know, to come in. We always had an office. Anishinaabe News in Old K Hall, then we had one over there by the University Center, and a couple of locations there. And they would set it up there at the print shop. Well, then, after we'd had a few issues. In fact, I still got the first one off the press. They brought it into my office. They wanted me to have it. That first issue of the Anishinaabe. And, one thing we covered, too, we were starting to get, and again, my office could cover this stuff. We brought some really top Native American people to campus. LaDonna Harris, who headed Americans for Indian Opportunity office in New York, or in Washington, D.C., and then her husband was a senator from Oklahoma who was a Democratic candidate for president back at that time. He didn't get the final nomination, but Fred Harris was, and she was a sharp. She was a part Comanche, part from down there in that area. She was a sharp woman. We gave her an honorary doctorate later on.
Yes.
And I used to have to go to Washington a couple times a year to meet with people, the granting agencies, you know, the federal, or mostly the governmental things. And I did have a chance to go over to LaDonna's office and stuff like that. We brought her, and then we got... his name's escaped me. He was head of the Indian Health Service.
Oh, yeah.
He was from the Southwest. Hmm?
Dr. What was his name?
Yes.
Crowfeather? Was it something?
Well, it could have been. I can't remember, but him. And, of course, Jambridge was behind us all the time. And to show you to what extent, we brought a leading Native American musician, pianist, and composer. And he wasn't one of these guys that, and he may kind of joke about it, this Hollywood background music, you know, for the Indians. Yeah, no, it was really good stuff. And so Dr. Jamrich would have a reception for them at his home, the president's house, for each one of these people. And I remember the president's house has a nice grand piano, and I remember the one for the Indian pianist there. And he had a really nice program there and played the piano. And well, that's just an example. Oh, then we had Beatrice Medicine. She was, I'm just giving you a little example, and you probably run across it, but Beatrice Medicine was a Sioux. She had her doctorate, full-blooded Sioux. And she came, and they all did, you know, made presentations and visited classes and when they were here. And she was here that one visit, I don't know, she was here a week or something like that. And then later on, she came, we gave her an honorary doctorate. Extremely capable people. I mean,
after that initial meeting with the Native Americans, what then became your, besides the newspaper?
Well, the newspaper was the centerpiece because it pulled everything together.
And what was the other vision that you took or Strolley took once you left that meeting based on what they said that you wanted to do?
Well, we didn't have an overall vision.
Even after that? Even after?
Well, we had a vision of what we wanted to help them do. But we never did say, now, we want to do this and we want to do that. We want to do this and this is our overall program. It was developed through the Indian people making the suggestions. This is what we need. This is what we need. And we went to work on it. Now, to give you an example, the Franciscan fathers had this big Indian school at Lawrence. Well, actually, Assiniboine, north of Berwick a little bit. There's a old Indian location where the reservation is called Assiniboine. Maybe you've heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there was this big building, looked something like the orphanage, but it was big. I don't know if they boarded students there. But anyway, the Franciscans, just at the time we were meeting up there, were closing their school or whatever. And it was a good building, very well maintained. And they had just left, and they had given it to the Indian community. But everything was out of it. There wasn't the only thing left down in the basement. It was about three stories, I think. Maybe two. But a nice brick building. Long, you know, rectangular building, sitting up there on the hill. Nice, beautiful location there, and there's quite a bit of property around it. Right next to Bishop Barrett's original mission house there, that stone house, it's gone now. So anyway, there was a printing press and a bunch of type, the old, you know, lead type in the basement for the fathers or the brothers or something, you know, used to do printing and stuff. The only thing they left, none of the stick of furniture, but the building was left just, you know, spotless. It was just really nice shape, everything good shape. So, Fred Dakota, then, the tribal chairman, was trying to think of something to do, you know, they could move their offices in there, but hell, it was a big building for a tribal office, you know. So he said, what we really need is some training for, like, office management and, you know, that kind of stuff to run their business. So Jim Goodell, who ran our business education or one of the programs, or he was, I don't know if he had a department head or if he was a real good professor. I don't know if you ever heard of Jim Goodell.
I have heard the name,
yeah.
Yes.
Well, so I met with Jim Goodell, And we met with Fred Dakota and some others, I don't remember, up there, and said, now just what kind of classes or instruction would you like? And so they outlined really what their need was. And so Jim, through his department there, set up some courses that we would go up there and teach. But didn't have any, even any desks or anything, nothing. No file cabinets or no nothing. So Northern had a bunch of stuff like that in storage that we had gotten from, I forget the term, through some federal grant, and we were finished with it. It was called on permanent loan. So what is a permanent loan? I don't know. It's kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah. So we loaded up a big truck, and on the Northern's big trucks there, with all kinds of goodies, you know, that we had gotten and were finished with. We got it through some federal grant, and we brought it up there and gave it to them. Of course, there's no government out here. The loan kept being permanent up there.
Yeah, exactly.
So that got them started. They got desks, and they not just student desks, but desks for their offices, and they got file cabinets and whatever we could bring up, and that got it going. And then, so our people went up there and held the classes at what was then called the Tribal Center. And that was in the summer. I remember this was getting going. But they didn't have any, it was coal-fired furnace. They didn't have any coal. So the Soo Line Railroad was still running to St. Ignace then. And they had a coal yard there or something. And if they were, they were by this time, of course, they were diesel. And so they volunteered to load the coal down there and bring it up to the railroad run right practically through the right in front of the Tribal Center, you know. Uh-huh. And so they volunteered, they gave them the coal and volunteered to bring it up on the train there, you know, so they did. And so that fired them through at least one winter, I don't know, after that. So that's the way, I mean, it was kind of, you know, it wasn't a grand program. It just kind of grew like Topsy, you know.
And did you meet with the Indian advisory group every so often to get feedback
We didn't meet very often. We did occasionally bring, they come to campus or something. But we were in constant contact with them. Pick up the phone and, you know, talk to this one or talk to that, whichever one we thought or several people who would be the most likely to be able to help us on a certain thing, see, because there was a broad representation of talent and Indian peoples and all the whole thing. So we didn't have occasion to have to call them to meeting all together, you know, very often. But we drew on them all the time for various things. That's what we did constantly, or we'd have single, or they'd come by themselves or with a few others, you know, and we'd meet about this project or about that one. And one of the things when we first started the Anishinaabe News, then the Indian students got the idea that we should have an Indian Awareness Week. And they never had anything like that. And it would help make the whole university community and the Marquette community and whatever else more aware of Indian culture. It wasn't a time to really protest or anything like that. It was more positive. And so we did. And that first Indian Awareness Week, it was in November or October, I forget. Anyway, the Donna Harris came as a special guest. And they had a parade on campus. I think, I don't think it went off campus. We got a good picture in one of the Anishinaabe News of LaDonna Harris and our Indian students marching with a banner and on campus in front of Old K Hall. And but then we just started to bring notable Indian people like Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, that author.
Yeah. Vine, was that it? No.
Oh, I should know. I sat in the Bavada Inn and had a beer with him. Oh. Well, he came, and then we had others, and they came either during an awareness week. Oh, Floyd Westerman.
All right.
Came 2-3 times, and he was played the role of chief in what was that real popular movie that came out?
Can't think of it.
Oh, you know, I just mentioned the name of it, and he played went all over it. It was a really good. Floyd was the Indian chief, but he was good on the guitar, and he had several record albums that were he had recorded. And this one Indian Awareness Week, LaDonna came and Floyd came, and then we had this guy Coy Eklund, and he grew up on the Sini stretch there. It's all gone now, but there was a little settlement called Walsh, halfway between Sini and Shingleton.
All right.
They had a gas station and a grocery store and some tourist cabins there. He went to school in Munising, closest school, and then he joined the Equitable Life Assurance Company. And by the time we had our Indian program, he was the president of it in New York.
Huh. Wow.
Before they moved to Walsh, they lived on an Indian reservation in Minnesota. He wasn't Indian, but his father had something to do with there. And Coy was sort of fluent in Ojibwa, and he was very interested in the Indian doing things for the Native Americans and in their language. Well, when we got through LaDonna, then he and LaDonna were real good friends, because Coy was very supportive of India, of women's rights at the time, Native American, and he was president of one of the biggest life assurance companies, which had made grants and stuff and backed this. So we had that Indian Awareness Week that one time. We had LaDonna there, we had Coy, and we had Floyd Westerman, all three at the same time.
Wow.
I remember one time they were staying at the Northland, or at the Heritage, what do they call that hotel?
Landmark, yes.
Yeah, and so we were sitting down in the bar there, all myself and Coy and LaDonna and Floyd. And he was sitting over by the bar. We were sitting at a booth there, and he was had his guitar and he was playing. just a little group there. Naive as I was, I said, Floyd, he was taking requests from us. I said, Floyd, how about this land is your land? And, he started going. I didn't know what was coming. And it had been a song he had recorded on one of his albums. And this land is my land, this land ain't your land. And he had the whole different lyrics.
That's great.
Yeah, it was great. And, Coy was a very proper, very nice guy. But he really backed, the Indians and the women's rights at that time. And he was widely recognized for that.
Huh.
He ended up publishing an Ojibwa dictionary. His heart was in the right place, but the Indians tell me it wasn't the greatest,
a dictionary.
Yeah, it was okay, but he wanted us to publish it. Well, I ran some of it by some of our Indian people, and they didn't want to hurt his feelings, but it wasn't really that great. He put a lot of work in on it, So eventually, I think the Equitable Life Insurance gave him the money to publish it. A pretty good size book. I got some copies in the basement there. But so anyway, I'm getting all far afield here. But it just there wasn't any grand plan, or it just grew, and it grew because the Indians led us where we should go.
Was there no talk at any point of a curriculum developed by
Norman? Yeah, no, right. I don't know how much you want to hear about this stuff, but yeah. So that was always in the back of our mind. And that the Indian guy that we brought from Bemidji State, that Ojibwa up there, who was on the faculty there, I mean, he was more of the academic type, and so was this Potawatomi from down, you know, down near Kalamazoo. But for some reason, we brought this Indian guy from Bemidji on campus specifically to pick his brain on how they got their academic program going and what they were offering. Because there weren't any around the United States much then. Even I think University of Arizona might have had something at the time, but it was pretty uncharted territory
as far as
from an academic standpoint. So we brought him here, and he gave us some materials, you know, outlines of what their academic program was. It wasn't a very big one, but they did have some courses. And then I wrote some memos around, and you know, send it, and had some. We had some academic people on our thing too, like Lou Peters, and we had. I'd have to look. It's been 40 years ago.
Yeah.
But we did, and we tried to get interest around the campus, and. They gave us some specific ideas of what kind of programs that would be good to develop academically.
When was this, approximately? Was this like...
Oh, well, this must have been... I think we started pretty soon on that. It was before 75, I think.
All right.
Yeah, but we started the initial effort in that regard. But you know, you have this academic... What is it, the committee that has to approve on them?
Yeah, CUP. That's what we call it.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, to get through them, or to get them to budge, they weren't like they were blocking anything. They never picked... Somebody on the academic side had to, you know, kind of take the ball and go forward with it. We could only go so far. You can't force a program like that.
No.
No.
Did you have support for the program amongst the faculty at all?
Not much, not really for academics. We had a lot of other things going for the Indians, you know, after the time went on. Other types of programs. We brought a lot of people on campus, some famous and some not so famous. And we got the, it wasn't too long, and Northern had a reputation. Hey, this was where things were happening for Indians.
And more so than anywhere in the state?
Pardon?
More so than any other school in the state?
One of the most, I won't say we were the leading school, but we sure were in the forefront. And a number of the issues that the Indians had originally brought up, we got into and we developed things, but they weren't academic. You know, a lot of things go on at a university that aren't necessarily officially, formally academic.
Right.
And that's where we started, because we didn't have to get approval from everybody in there, you know, on that committee and like that. And some of the... I never was an academic person there. I had nothing against academics. But sometimes there's a kind of attitude among academics, a little kind of holier-than-thou type. You know what I mean? Or mm-hmm. just if you're not an academic, they don't listen to you too much.
Well, how did Strolley react to you?
Well, Strolley was... Strolley always gave us support, and I never was told, well, hey, well, sometimes on the paper, you gotta, you know, but I never did. One time, not to get off here, but one time when AI, American Indian movement was going strong, and there was those problems out at on that reservation there, serious ones. But we were reporting it. We had people, and we had our Indian students were in touch with people who were right there, and we were having stories about what was actually going on. And it wasn't a story to be on one side or another, but it was trying to, well, of course, Indians had some definite sympathies. But I was visited one time by a FBI agent in my office. You know, he just wanted to, well, wasn't an FBI man killed out there?
Yeah, I think you're right.
And I was fine. We had a good conversation, and I was totally open with him. And he could see that we as a university or as a newspaper were in that had no real official ties with AIM. But it was just one of the really important things going on with American Indians in the United States at the time. And the Anishinaabe News covered all kinds of things from the Washington's, you know, things going on in Washington and so forth, legislation. And we just couldn't ignore what was going on out there in South Dakota, pretend that it wasn't happening. So we had to, and some of it was front page news. And so he was just trying to check out and see what, you know, what kind of ties we had and what involvement we had in some of those, developing those stories. And I must have satisfied him, because I never heard from him again, and nobody else did on the paper. So just one of those things. We had some criticism within the institution.
Criticism on the coverage or criticism?
Well, some things, well, this is the, part of it was, well, maybe we better get that off campus. Because I had the guy, Earl McIntyre, I don't think he was around when you came, but he was director of communications. And we weren't under him, but he was, obviously he had a vested interest in what we were doing. And at one time he said, we got to get this thing off campus. Well, it didn't go. So I never had any arguments with people or about any of the Indian program or the newspaper, but I heard what they said, and that was it. I listened to them, and we had good conversations, communication, but then we just went on and did what we thought should be done, and nobody blocked us.
Did any of the Indians that on the advisory committee recommend or push for an academic program of any sort, or courses, or anything like that, or did they not see that report?
Well, I'll tell you, at that time, there were very few Native Americans that had a college degree. You wouldn't think that'd be the case, but it was. And higher degrees, there were, you could call them on the fingers of a couple of, you know, your two hands. I'm sure they were scattered around, but the ones that were well-known, and I know you lived in some places in the Southwest, and then probably a few in California, and of course, there wasn't just that much of a, I just want to say, they didn't value it as much as they came to later.
All right.
I mean, the basic things then were just to get, just like with the blacks, to get basic rights. They had the treaty rights from the beginning of this country, but They never were enforced. Just like the fishing around here. We had Fred Hatch. He was from the Sioux, and he and I became good friends. And his father was, for years, old Fred Sr., was the chairman of what they used to call the original band of Chippewa Indians there at the Sioux that covered that whole East End. Well, Fred, his son, Fred Jr., was studying to get his law degree. Right when we were doing all his interests, he was one of our major consultants, and he'd come up a lot, and we just became real good friends. So one of his main things was so many of these rights that were granted to the Michigan Indians were never realized because, for one thing, the people in charge, the law enforcement people and the legislators like that, they just kind of ignored them. So they didn't have their fishing rights. They didn't have their hunting rights. This was in the early 70s. So Fred was getting his law degree so that he could get into that. And he got his law degree. In the meantime, he was running an office in the Sioux for the Indians. Excuse me. I just let it go. I've done an answering thing there. I think it was state funded, maybe by the federal, and it was assistance to the Indians. I think kind of advising them on some of their legal problems, but he wasn't an attorney. But he did get his law degree, and then it was Fred that got into forming the cases that brought it before the Michigan Supreme Court in subsequent years. But Fred was, and we had covered a lot of that, all kinds of stuff in the Anishinaabe News on that, informing the Indian people. So see, the newspaper at that time, I mean, it was a central force entity there in informing the Indian people of their what's major things going on. The secular press wasn't covering it like that.
Right.
We covered it, and we had sources like Fred Ash, you know. And he was outspoken, but a good guy and a hard worker and just totally dedicated. So anyway, Fred got his degree, and then he formed those cases. He gave me some of his manuscripts there that he had, when he was forming his case, you know, and that he had written out. And, I had those for a long time. And I finally, his son, Fred Jr.'s son, which was all John Hatch, was editor of Anishinaabe News for a while, was a Northern student, got a degree here, and so did his sister, Nancy Hatch. See, Nancy was also Fred Sr.'s granddaughter, and so forth. So, anyway, I was going to tell you about the... John was editor for quite a while, and of course his dad was doing all this stuff in the legal end of it, so we carried a lot of good information, really well informed in the newspaper. And so the Indian community all over the Great Lakes, but in this area primarily, was well informed of what was going on and what they were trying to do. So when you say, well, weren't the Indians more interested in academics? Yeah, but there was some very major basic stuff, like these treaty rights that Northern had, through the newspaper, had a major role in disseminating the information and keeping the people, you know, informed and on track for that. And Fred Hatch used it, and we were happy to be used. And... So, I mean, there were some really important things that we were involved in at Northern that we were helping that weren't academic.
I see.
And were more important.
Right.
Than the academic.
Right.
Now, I can't overemphasize that. And I haven't talked to many people at all about the overview of this period. But, we were involved in a lot of things that... and. Our Indian students at the beginning are coming, and they're almost apologetic. I mean, you know, they just, They have this confidence and pride. They had pride, but it was buried under too much crap, you know, and discrimination and all that for years and years. And it was so good to see these Indian students come and just develop a pride and, you know, a sense of they could do things for themselves and get these things going. And, I mean, it was just, I get all carried away when I talk about it. Sorry.
No, that's all right. That's it.
Yeah, they had suffered so much. So anyway, we had a lot of stuff on our plate.
That sounds like it.
Yeah, and we worked hard. And Dr. Strolley was behind us. President Jammers was wonderful. And he stayed way in the background. He never projected himself. But he always was there, and he did very kind things, and like these receptions at his house.
Yeah. Was there any underlying current against you? Any force?
Pardon?
Were there any forces against you at the university that had power enough?
Well, there wasn't anything that. The president was for us. Dr. Strolley was always behind us. And I had a free rein of the thing, I mean, for better or for worse. And, I'll tell you, things are in, there was nothing when we started. I mean, the Indian people just have been discriminated against and their culture shattered in a way and for so long.
Did it continue to grow? Did the program continue to grow, or did it reach stagnation at any point?
No, it didn't. It didn't really reach stagnation. Jammers was all. What happened was that goes against so many things is the finances. It went along good. I left R&D in 75. Dr. Strolley retired. I went over to communications office, but I still kept being advisor and working with Anishinaabe News right up until the original expired. And the whole thing was we had an Indian office that was set up for Indian programs. I think it was called American Indian Programs then. And they weren't academic programs, but they were, it helped Indian students with financial aid and all kinds of stuff that affected Indian students. That office got going. Nancy Hatch, was she the first one? Well, we had a series of people that really good people. One of them we brought in from California, somebody else from somewhere else, and ran the Office of American Indian Programs, but it wasn't academic.
Right, Robert Bailey, wasn't he one of the first?
Well, I ran the thing till 72, just in the Research and Development Office. I never had a formal title, but Bob was the first one we brought in and had the title of Director of American Indian Programs. Yeah, he was an Ottawa from Peshawastown, Traverse City area.
Uh-huh.
And he had been teaching high school in Lansing. He had a degree from MSU and really good guy. We became really good friends, and to the point he took a bunch of us fishing every year up in Canada, you know, in the boonies.
Nice.
Yeah. So anyway, Bob Bailey was our first one, and he served until 78. Yeah. And then I can't remember if Nancy, I got him all listed, and I gave it to the archive, and I got it in my file, all the directors and their dates of service.
It was a female, I think, that was next. I can't remember her name.
Yeah, there was. She didn't stay too long. And then there was this this guy from California. He was here several years. Yeah, I don't remember all of them, but I worked with all of them. I made it a point, even when I went over to communications. And what happened, I was going to say, Michigan had a real sharp economic downturn around 79-80 involving the auto industry and so forth. And Northern, along with other universities, was really in a bind. They had to have some, not as bad as currently, but or the 08 turned down, but things were really tight. So we tried the best we could to keep the Anishinaabe News going. We got a little grant here, and we had a granting agency in England that gave us a couple $1,000s, and I mean, we just, any place we could get some money. And we kept it going until I think 82. But then we just simply ran out of, the Indian program didn't collapse or anything, but we just didn't have the money for that. And then the university was charging us like, I don't know, $1,500 a year for the Indian office. And that was, or maybe it wasn't 15, but it was over 1,000. And I mean, there were things that, and then the printing costs and like that, we just couldn't do it anymore. We tried to convert it into a quarterly, but there wasn't even money for that. And Nancy Hatch had her hands full with keeping that office going over there, you know. And so we just, we had to let it go. But the idea was, the seed was still there, and that's what they started this new Anishinaabe News, you know, that they have now.
Right.
It comes out a quarterly.
All right.
And it's all done on computer. That saved us a lot of money because you didn't have to have we developed an office where we could, this was an offset, so you had to paste stuff. I don't know if you're familiar. You didn't have hot lead, but you had to have a way to set type, and then you waxed the back of the galleys, and then you had to paste it all up on layout sheets, and you brought the layout sheets in to the printer, who took a picture of them and made a plate and then made the thing. So I helped them, and they did most of the work, but we got some plywood, and we built long kind of desk or say surface here on a kind of a slant that you could stand at and lay out the paper.
All right.
And of course, we couldn't afford any copiographic machine to set it up that would type it up in columns. So the mining journal set up the copy for us.
Oh, all right.
And on galleys, you know, the galley is that long galley. That comes from the old hot lead days of the galley. But anyway, so they set up, the students would send down the copy to the journal, and then the journal would set it up, and then we would bring it back to campus, and we had a waxer, and then you'd run it through there, and then we had, the headlines, I think, had to be set up at the journal, too. Hmm. We didn't have a headline machine. So all that had to be laid out the way we want, you know. And so you see some of those broadsheet papers, the students laid that out. Huh. And I'd go over there, and because they did, you know, somebody had to teach them how to do that. And I had known that, so that's the one thing I taught them directly. But we would go over there and lay out the paper, and on the layout sheets. The layout sheets all had light blue lines about far apart as notebook paper, you know, so you had something to line up your columns with. But light blue won't pick up with the camera. See, when they brought it down to the, that color won't pick up. So it was all there, and we'd lay it out and put the place for the photos. We had to size the photos because some photos were bigger than we wanted. We had to size them, you know, and we had a wheel for that and all that stuff. So, and then they had just put a piece of black paper where the photo would go. So then we call those flats. We take the flats down, and we had to bid that out because just like you'd bid out anything where you'd get the cheapest price, you know.
Right.
Yeah. And so we had the Manistique Pioneer Tribune gave us the best bid. And so I'd go down, we'd get a station wagon and the editor and some of the staff and myself, we'd go down to Manistique with the flats, and then they'd run it off the press while we were down there.
Oh, I see.
And then we would load up the wagon, we'd take a big wagon and a station wagon and bring it home. And I tell you, those students are resourceful. There was this one gal from the Sioux. Oh, I can't think of her name. And she was a little bit older student, but boy, was she a good cook. And when she'd load up a big picnic basket, and we'd take the flats, and we'd stop at some nice place along Lake Michigan there before I got to Manistique, and we'd have a little picnic, you know, and then we'd go on to the...
That's great.
Yeah, and so they would run that was broadsheet then, the full size. And then we did it a while at GLAD. The Delta Reporter in Gladstone got the contract. And I don't think the Mining Journal ever printed. No, they never printed. The Tabby was first printed up at the Globe. See, the Globe did all the setup because we didn't have anything then. But then after we got our own way of laying stuff out, then we'd bring it mostly to Manistique and then for a while to Gladstone. But that's what we'd do. That was about my only hands-on help with that paper, because they wrote it, and I didn't edit it ahead of time.
Huh.
No, they had an editor and that kind of thing, and I didn't say, no, you know, you're getting too much here, or, you know, let's balance it a little more. Or the only thing I told him, I said, you got to be real careful about letters to the editor, you know, that they're accurate, and or, you know, you had to be a little more careful with letters to the editor, because sometimes, you know, anybody could write into the
right.
paper, and sometimes they weren't fit to be published. But they did everything. And, I mean, the students, I can't say enough about those students, the abilities.
Yeah.
They never were trained in journalism.
Huh.
And we had one student, gee, she was a good feature writer, do a whole page, you know, nice. And then some of them would do some pen and ink illustrations or photos. Then she went on, I can't think of her name, but she went on and joined the American Indian, it was like a law institute, legal. It represented American, they weren't lawyers, but they published, I forget, it was headquartered, I think, in Denver. But she went out from there and got a job with them. That paper was responsible because the students did such a good job. I mean, they didn't have a hard time getting a job.
Wow,
sometimes
that's
they
great.
Identified themselves with the Anishinaabe News.
Wow.
In Indian circles, or, you know, in stuff that way.
Huh.
You know, it was just kind of like a miracle, as far as I'm concerned. It just, they did such a good job.
When did you, so...
Oh, getting back to the academics.
Yeah.
Yeah, we keep...
That's
well,
all right. These are good stories.
I didn't make, when I was connected with the thing, we just didn't make much progress that way. We had so many important things that we had to focus on and put our energies on that had to come before academics. So what the program did here in Northern was get the Indian people in an organization on their feet with good advisors and focus on the things that they thought were the most important to accomplish. And that's what we, those first 5 years there, 6 years, that's, boy, that's what we did. We all, we never, you know, took our eyes off of an eventual academic program. And like I say, we did bring people on campus to advise us and to, but we didn't have, there wasn't a realization of the need for academic programs in Indian, in the Indian area. And very few colleges were really going into it, other than just a, just for, I don't say just for show, but you know, oh yeah, we got our Indian program, maybe a course or two or something.
Right.
So, and even our universities in Michigan, that's why one of them, we went to Bemidji, because, you know, there's a lot of Indians up there. And they were one of the first in Bemidji State to really go into the academic area. That's not a big school, no. You know, but that they did. And so Northern was, you know, in virgin territory there.
Right.
You know, and so, but then eventually, as the program evolved and matured, and there was more realization and support in the faculty. Like we had a, the guy was the head of the English department here, and he was here when you were, and his wife was real strong too in sporting Indian things. And then we had Pish, we called him. She's still on the faculty.
Pish Cianciolo?
Yes. And I was on a committee with her just before I retired on multicultural stuff. But she, you know, a few people like that around that, and it just slowly, you know, you didn't go and tell the faculty what they should, you know. But they eventually, it came around and we got the support, and you know, now we got an academic program. We even got a major now, don't we?
Yes.
Yeah, we got the major, and that's just recently.
Right.
That's all how long it's taken.
Yeah, I guess so. 50 years almost.
Yeah. But that was always in the future. But the Indian people didn't feel that way. They had some other more basic important stuff, and we helped them with that.
Right. I see.
Yeah, and it just slowly grew. I mean, the realization came about, and the whole, you know, the country's changed.
Yeah, it has.
And the Indians, along with the blacks, along with the Hispanics, things are changing.
Right. Yes.
The trouble with the Indian culture and stuff, compared to other ethnic groups, Indians aren't that many. You know, there are, Indians are so often, even to this day, and another thing too, it's the Indian culture, I don't know how to express this, but you know when they have a conference or when they go around in a circle, yeah, and nobody wants to speak out and be the big shot in it. Everybody, you know, you have your talking stick, and everybody says what, but they don't. You don't want to show up anybody. You work with. It's a community, and they're very careful not to. Oh, Indian politics can be pretty rugged, you know, among themselves, but generally in their interactions. You don't want to appear smarter than somebody else, or you know. So they don't push themselves.
I see.
Indian people don't like you get other groups like Cesar Chavez, you know, we had him on campus too. It was part of the Indian program, because I think he's got Indian. Yeah, we had him. But, you know, they're more outspoken.
Right.
Indian people, you can't put your finger on one Indian that right now and says, hey, this guy really gets up in front of the mic and or right. whatever. They don't do it that way.
I see. That's interesting.
They don't do it that way. It's a whole different thing. And so when you're working with them, everybody makes decisions as a group. You know, some are, you know, more forthcoming than others, just like anybody. Some people can express themselves better. Indians can be very, very expressive in the proper context. But they don't function that way, and they don't go forward that way. Way back when we started, there were some Indian leaders. I remember one guy from the Bad River up there by Ashland.
Uh-huh.
They were so concerned about what was happening to the environment. And we had some, I remember this one guy, he and I had some really good talks and stuff. And they've got prophecies of what might be happening to our environment. And damn it, it looks to me like they're coming to pass.
Wouldn't be surprised. Yeah.
Well, it is.
Yeah.
They're very spiritual people. I mean, there's Indians. I mean, the whole, range like anybody else. But they're very spiritual people.
Huh.
Yes, they are.
What tribe was that you were talking about?
Huh?
What tribe was that in particular that was particularly prophetic about the future?
Well, I think this guy from Bad River mentioned it to me, and then there were other Indians. I dealt with so many Indians over the years, I can't remember who said what
right.
but, about these things. But I remember those things. And, of course, I've always been interested. I was co-chair of the first Earth Day we had on campus in 72, maybe. I think 72. Uh-huh. Lou Peters and I were co-chairs
right.
of that Earth Day. So, I mean, we've always been interested in, and concerned about that. But the Indian people, some people, you know, they think, oh, they're backward, and you know how they, man, they really regard nature in a spiritual way.
Yeah.
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 I don't mean in a, you know, superstitious. We've all, our ancestors have had superstitions here, but the Indians see it as, we're all one. We're one with the animals. We're one with the birds. We're one with nature.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a circle, you know. You can't harm one part of it without another part feeling the repercussions,
right.
you know.
Right.
And there's sweat lodges, and they're very, I mean, gosh, some of the Indian people, I mean, they're so appreciative and respectful for nature. Not that they don't believe in the Kichimanitu, you know, the great spirit. But they believe in other spirits too, so did a lot of other cultures, you know.
Right.
But, yeah, it just, it's a different culture, and I learned. I had a couple uncles, Indian uncles, but they were, you know, I never learned Indian culture from them. They were, you know, one lock worked on the locks all his life, and the other lived up there in Launce, and I liked both of them a lot, especially one that I knew better. But it's different. It's, I just don't know just how, you know, it's, you can't just put it in a few words, but
right.
they have a different approach to you know, to each other, or their relationships. They're not not forthcoming, that's not the word. They don't project their ideas and stuff in a strong way.
I see.
They just don't do that. That isn't the way you do it.
Right.
But they live it. But that's why it was, well, they did a resist, of course. We had, you know, battles with the Indians, but they weren't out to kill white men. They were out to preserve their territory.
Right.
They had every attribute of an independent nation. They had their own culture. They had their own language. They had their own territory. But we didn't respect that. The Quakers did. The Quakers were the ones that really, William Penn, and formed treaties and stuck by them. And that's why they had such good relationship with the Indians. Huh. Our ancestors, the Carters, came over with William Penn.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah. And in they helped get Philadelphia going. And William Carter was the mayor of Philadelphia back in 1710 and 11. There was only about as many people as Nagani at the time.
Right. That's pretty funny.
But anyway, so the Indians were, they were just fighting for their existence. And, you know, they were going to, when they were relocating these Indians out west, they were going to relocate these Great Lakes Indians too, the Ojibwas.
Uh-huh.
And I forget, something happened. And they were about to do that, and it just went by the boards. They didn't do it. That's why the Ojibwas are pretty much, you know, where they've always been.
Right.
Since they come from Canada.
Right.
But a lot of the other Indians, of course, were pushed out west. But you know all that story. That's just... But the Indian culture is... you get to know the fine points of the culture, and then you can understand so much more.
Right.
So anyway, getting back... Wrapping this up, I guess, unless you have other questions, but Northern's program was so much more than just an academic-oriented program. And at the beginning, it tackled some really big, basic issues that were all over the United States. And the Anishinaabe News, now that was totally a student operation. That was the catalyst, and that voiced so many of the concerns and reflected what they wanted to do and so forth. And it was one of three in the United States.
Wow, that's impressive.
It is.
Very impressive.
Yeah, it was one of three. You know, Akwesasne Notes is still going, I think. Wasaha, I don't know. Now, we had Dickie Laughing on campus. He was in a Mohawk from northern New York, right where the Akwesasne was published. And he was a neat little guy. Huh. And he wore his hair in braids. I don't know. He heard us, I guess, through the Anishinaabe News. He came here and got his degree. But he worked he volunteered in the public schools around here, and he'd go in. And he was real good with kids. And I'd say he must have been close to 40, maybe in his late 30s. And but he would go to all the schools and work with the kids on Indian culture, and he was very popular.
Huh.
Yeah. And he, of course, worked on the Anishinaabe News, and he was involved in all kinds of things. And then when he graduated from Northern, he got a job up in a Canadian's... a school up north of Thunder Bay. You know where Thunder Bay
yeah.
is? Yeah. Up in there, I can't remember the name, but way back. And every so often he'd call me up when he was teaching there and at night and on his wireless phone, and I don't know what it was, but I mean, just like he was in the next room.
Really? Wow.
Well, he ended up tragically, though. He had a priest friend. He was really strong into the Indian native spirituality. But he had this priest friend, and they were out canoeing in British Columbia, or was it Alberta, up in the Rockies there, in this long, big, long, narrow lake with this priest friend. And it was kind of notorious for having erratic winds come down, you know. And all of a sudden, the lake got... It got pretty stormy, and the lake and the canoe capsized. The priest was able to swim to shore, but Dickie drowned.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yes, that was too bad. He contributed a lot to our program. Yeah, he was full-blooded Mohawk.
Huh.
And boy, 100% Indian. Oh. He wasn't, you know, but
yeah.
Really good guy. Huh. And smart. And he called Dickie Laughing. And I don't know how he got his surname, but he laughed a lot.
Did he? Appropriate name, then.
So you know how they name their Indian sometimes?
Yes.
Having to do with some characteristic or something, you know, that's how they originally got their surnames.
Yeah, well, I remember when you were trying to talk about that dentist, was it that health guy? It was George Spruce someone, wasn't
it? Oh, Blue Spruce.
Blue Spruce.
See, there you got it. Blue Spruce.
Yes, exactly.
He was a Sharpie guy, too. Well, they all, he was way up at the top there in Washington. But in Indian affairs.
But.
Yeah, it was just one of the most rewarding times of my life.
Wow, that's awesome.
And I never planned it that way. I just kind of fell into it.
All right. Well.
And I can't take a lot of credit, only I just kind of hung in there.
Well, you started it through your, you know, that was key, I think. That,
yeah. Well, and I had the support where we needed.
Yes, that's true.
We did have some people who thought, you know, you say Carter and his Indians. It was a joke around campus because I was sticking up for the Indian show. But it wasn't. I had good friends that would say it would use that term just kind of jokingly, you know. And I never took offense by it. That's just the way it was. But, yeah, it was a wonderful opportunity and just to learn and to work with the Indian people and, yeah, help get the things going. But, it was just one of those things that happened.
Right. Well, that's good to know. Yeah, you filled in a lot of questions for me. I'm looking at my list of questions, and I don't think there's any
here. I haven't given you much chance to ask them.
No, I figured it's best to let you just talk about it, because otherwise I fragment it if I interrupt and ask questions. I'd ask some if I thought you missed something, but you got it all, so I don't really worry about it. So, and if there's something else.
Well, I appreciate this opportunity because I haven't had many.